You're listening to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm your host, as always, Ankit Panda, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Franz Stefan Gadi, who just returned from a 3.5 week long embed with the 201st Corps of the Afghan National Army in Nangarhar Province and the NATO Resolute Support Mission in Kandahar and Kabul. And while in Afghanistan, Franz got a firsthand glimpse of just how the Afghan National Army, NATO, and the United States are operating in this still fragile state. Now, over the course of this podcast, Franz and I will discuss some of his impressions about the state of the Afghan security forces. Franz has a very unique perspective here of actually seeing what's happening on the battlefield in Afghanistan in some ways, which is often difficult to glean if you're just reading general media reports. So that'll be very valuable. And I'm looking forward to getting his impressions on that. Now, Franz did a lot of great reporting for The Diplomat while he was there that I'll link to in the description for this podcast that you can check out if you want to look at some of this stuff in more detail. First, Franz, before I turn it over to you, I do want to, provide some context for the critical time at which you were in Afghanistan. So, November 2014, we had essentially the first month of this National Unity Government in Kabul. It was the first successful domestic transfer of power in the country's history, and there was a lot of uncertainty about the security situation since the United States had just signed the bilateral security agreement, and it actually came very late. They would have preferred to have done it earlier, but things were ramping down. Obviously, last year saw a sort of misguided rapprochement with Pakistan and Afghanistan, which suggested that maybe the Ghani government thought, Ashraf Ghani is the president of Afghanistan. It suggests that maybe he thought that by working with Pakistan, the security situation could be improved. In August, that obviously fell apart. We learned that Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, had been dead for 2 years over the summer as well. And then finally, in September, after a power struggle in the Taliban, the group essentially surged in the north of the country and managed to successfully siege the city of Kunduz, which represented the fall of the first major Afghan city since the 2001 invasion. It was a very unsettling event for those of us who watch Afghanistan closely. And obviously, Franz arrived in Afghanistan barely 2 months after the fall of Kunduz. So I believe, Franz, when you were there, everybody had kind of the dust had settled on Kunduz. People had been debriefed. The security situation was clearer. The Heart of Asia Conference was just gearing up to take place, which is a multilateral forum on the future of Afghanistan security. So, anyways, that's the context of the time at which you were in Afghanistan. Now, Franz, I'm going to turn it over to you because you were all over this country. So to start us off, why don't you tell us a bit about your itinerary in Afghanistan and just where you were so our listeners have an idea of just the geography of your perspective.
Well, thank you, Ankit, for this wonderful introduction, and it's good to be back on the program. I spent 3.5 weeks in the country in November and December of last year, and I traveled to three different provinces: Nangarhar, Pawrhan, and Kandahar. And I also spent some time in Kabul. As you already said, I embedded with NATO and Afghan security forces in those places, just in order to try to get an understanding how the war will progress in 2016. And just to give you a short answer on the military situation, I think that the military stalemate that we witnessed in 2015 will continue into 2016. I do not think that the Afghan National Security and Defense Forces will disintegrate. And I also do not think we will see a repeat of a Kunduz-like scenario with a major urban population center falling into the hands of the Taliban for a prolonged time, for the simple reason that NATO and the United States will not allow it. While I was there, I was constantly thinking about long-term trends. What's the long-term trend really that we're witnessing now on the ground in Afghanistan? And maybe I can illustrate what I want to say with an anecdote from the front lines, from Ashin District in Nangarhar Province. As you know, Ankit, I spent some time at the front line in Ashin District with the 201st Corps of the Afghan National Army. A corps essentially is somewhat like a NATO or US division in the NATO and US military forces. Ashin District in eastern sorry in southern Nangarhar province is considered to be the epicenter of ISIS activity in the country. And while I was embedded there in Ashin, I came across an interesting man named Syed Chal Pacha, a former top Taliban commander in the district who is now fighting along government forces against the Islamic State there. And just a small tiny anecdote about this, his family, his son and 100 men, also mostly former Taliban fighters, wrested a strategically important hill from the hands of the Islamic State during one of the battles along the AFPAC border while I was there, which was pretty impressive. In any case, before switching sides, this former Taliban commander, Pacha, had been fighting the government for about 13 years. And he was also heavily involved in the drug trade and allegedly also maintained his own private prison in the district. And while some probably would say that his defection could be interpreted as a momentary alignment or realignment to the tune of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, I thought that this temporary alliance that I saw on the battlefield illustrated something else. I think that it is an example of a hedging, or if you want to call it a parachute strategy, by Afghan power brokers to prepare for the eventuality of a cessation of military and economic aid to the country that seems to be occurring throughout Afghanistan. And the logic behind this hedging strategy is quite simple. There appears to be an understanding that the war will not be decided on the battlefield, but on the donor table, which I also believe is true. And as long as international economic and military aid keeps flowing, the centralized Kabul government as the principal dispenser of this aid will retain influence and legitimacy among Afghan power brokers, including the warlords in the provinces. Once the aid flow stops, however, or is substantially reduced, I think Afghan history teaches that one either has to have loyal tribal forces at one's disposal and or seek some form of understanding with local power brokers like Sahed Chayal Pacha, former Taliban commander in Ashin district. And I think that's very true if you look at Afghanistan's recent history. For example, in the 90s, after the Soviet withdrawal, the Moscow-sponsored Afghan communist regime remained in power only as long as it was able to finance tribal forces like Abdul Rashid Dostum's militia guarding the regime's land link to the Soviet Union in the northeast of the country. And once Soviet funds were cut, the Afghan government had no more supplies and money to offer, and the tribal militias turned on Kabul. And the communist regime failed to obtain the loyalty of tribes because it took too long devising a strategy or a hedging strategy that would offer the tribes, next to money, also political participation.
Yeah, can I actually I do want to ask you about this because I think this is a very interesting line of reasoning that you're bringing up. You know, one of the questions that I wonder about, that I've written about, and a lot of people have sort of suggested is the case, is that the Taliban, you know, when we talk about the Taliban, we're not talking about a unitary monolithic group with a clear command and control structure that, you know, goes straight from Mullah Mansour, the group's leader, to the frontline fighters. Because, you know, as you correctly noted, if you look at Afghanistan's history, you have a strong history of tribal warlordism across the country. And, you know, that has manifested with the Taliban. So obviously, I think that, you know, you're onto something with this idea that Kabul will effectively become a power broker because of its ability to dole out the aid. But, you know, for example, this former Taliban leader that you met, how universal do you think his story can be? Because obviously, you know, there'll be many former leaders or current Taliban leaders like him across the country who will have, you know, a series of different interests. For example, in the north, you know, near Kunduz, we've heard stories of, you know, not only Pashtun Taliban leaders, but, you know, warlords and tribal leaders from other groups, including Uzbeks and Hazaras, now becoming involved with the Taliban, which suggests that, you know, the power dynamics in Afghanistan among the tribes are just so complex and dynamic that it's very hard to generalize, you know, a people's interests. So what's your perspective on that? You know, just how unified is the Taliban and how generalizable are these trends?
Well, I think you're absolutely correct in saying that it's very difficult to generalize anything about Afghanistan. You know, the different provinces are very different in many, many ways. In general, I do think that there is a long-term trend, and that trend leads more towards fragmentation rather than cohesion when it comes to both sides of this conflict, the Taliban side and the government side. And on the government side, we can see different militias popping up, stepping in when the Afghan National Security and Defense Forces cannot protect certain districts or certain roads and urban population centers anymore. And on the Taliban side, we also see a fragmentation of splitting up into different factions, and of course the emergence of ISIS. I think what I saw in the last 3 weeks is sort of just will amplify the problems of this, so-called peace process, because at the end of the day, it's a trend that we've been seeing already since, I believe, 2010, when because of a very aggressive airstrike campaign by the United States, which decapitated a lot of the senior leadership of the Taliban. Different new leaders emerged that were not as that would not really give up their power to the centralized Taliban command as easily as their predecessors, who most often fought alongside senior Taliban leaders during the Soviet occupation already. But just maybe to come back to my original point, I do think that the current situation in Afghanistan is a catch 22. Which also affects the military situation or the military efficiency of the Afghan National Security and Defense Forces, because while the continuous flow of foreign aid may lead to an over-centralization of resources in Kabul, which I think is best exemplified with the Afghan army's notorious, quote, hoarding culture at its main supply centers in the city of Kabul. Cutting military and economic aid as well will almost certainly spell disaster for the Afghan government and its military forces by forcing them to actually enter dubious alliances with former insurgents like Syed Jalal Pasha. And all of this, of course, in turn undermines the government's legitimacy in the eyes of the Afghan people. But as long as there is no firm commitment from the Western side to the Afghan government, I think it is understandable that they are pursuing what I would call a hedging or a parachute strategy. And I think the obvious major problem of pursuing a hedging strategy for the Afghan government in particular is that it delegitimizes all actors involved, which also, I think, brings problems for the Taliban members participating in those negotiations. And then, of course, fighting an enemy and simultaneously paying him off or offering political participation fundamentally undermines the belief in the government and, more importantly, in its legitimacy.
In some ways, though, this has kind of been known for some time, right? Because the High Peace Council and the entire, the peace and reconciliation process with the Taliban, while it hasn't succeeded to this day, the assumption has always been that the fighting will cease, the war will end, and the Taliban will be folded in to the current political system of Afghanistan and participate peacefully in Afghan democracy. So, is that, is what you're describing sort of similar to that end goal, which I think is what the peace talks are aspiring to, or is this something separate, something more tactical?
That's a very good question, and I wish I could give you an answer to this. But I think right now, what I see, it's merely at the tactical level.
Okay.
Although, as you say, it has been a trend for the past 4 to 5 years, in my opinion, and it doesn't come out of nowhere that this is occurring. Right?
Right.
Everyone, I remember participating in a Track 2 discussion in Kabul in 2010. Where one of the principal UN peace negotiators for Afghanistan participated, and he already said that time is running out. The senior Taliban leadership is little by little being eliminated and replaced by much more radical younger leaders, and there's not a lot of time to start negotiating. And now we are here 5 years later, and still there hasn't been a lot of progress. So I think prospects generally are very dim at this stage, yeah.
Yeah, and also an important piece of context for some of our listeners. So after Mullah Omar's death, Mullah Akhtar Mansur was appointed the leader, essentially replacing Omar. He was Omar's essentially left-hand man while he was alive. But in November, a splinter group of the Taliban appointed another leader, Mullah Muhammad Rasul. So now there's essentially two kind of locuses of power within the Taliban, although the Rasul faction is generally based out of Nimruz and is much, much smaller than the fighters that have sworn their allegiance to Mansoor. So there is a clear split right now within the Taliban. Franz, I do want to ask you a bit about the Islamic State, since that's something that's obviously of a lot of interest to particularly a lot of observers in the US, and I guess globally, with the Islamic State being such a hot topic. What is your sense of the extent to which the Islamic State is there to stay in Afghanistan, and how do the Afghan security forces themselves see the Islamic State threat?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I think again you can't really generalize it, for the entire country. I think that it is a legitimate threat in eastern Afghanistan, along all the provinces bordering Pakistan. It is less of a threat in the south, in Helmand or Kandahar province. Although there are elements, ISIS elements there, but I do not think that they will have a strategic impact on this year's fighting season. In the east, the story is very different. What was interesting when I was at the front lines, for example, is that most of the units fighting, most of the Afghan National Army units fighting ISIS there along the Afpak border were convinced that they were fighting the regular Pakistani army in disguise. What one of their leaders, for example, told me is that Afghanistan should finally declare all-out war against Pakistan to finally at least break this conflict out into the open. Although whenever I pressed different officers and men for evidence about the connection between the Pakistani military and ISIS fighters, they couldn't really produce or, point towards anything. In general, I do think that the majority of ISIS fighters in eastern Afghanistan are coming from Pakistan. They're infiltrating Afghanistan through a number of valleys that are intersecting the mountain ranges dividing Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I do also think that they have initially received funding from Iraq and Syria. For example, ISIS fighters are getting paid a stipend once they join ISIS, between $400 to $500. At least that's what people over there told me. And the Taliban are not really paying that much money, or no money at all for anyone joining them. Generally, also the Afghan army fighting ISIS told me that they are much better trained, better equipped, much more motivated than the Taliban, and on top, also much more vicious in what they are doing to their enemies and what they are doing to the local population. Now, do they have a staying power? I think they do. I don't think it's going to spread the way it did in Iraq for a number of reasons. First of all, it's the geography of the country that's very different. Very difficult to fight your way out of some of those valleys, especially in the east. Also, I think there's a fundamental difference between Pashtun culture, because most of those ISIS fighters are actually Pashtun, and the ideology that is promoted by the Islamic State, so that there's no natural symbiosis as there was in Iraq and Syria on a number of ideological issues. So I think that's it's not a given. And I also generally think that the Afghan national security and defense forces have improved over the years, despite of what you've seen and also what I've seen on the front lines. Of course, you can't really compare them to frontline, crack troops, of a NATO country, but they nevertheless have been fighting the Islamic State and continue to fight the Islamic State, most of the time also without any Western support. While I was on the front line, I did not really see any NATO forces involved supporting the campaign, and they're also capable of conducting very complex military operations at this stage. I saw the interaction of artillery, infantry movements, close air support, all of these things that you repeatedly read in the papers, weaknesses of the Afghan army, and they're managing. I think they'll be able to hold on to all the major urban population centers in 2016. To conclude, I do think that the Islamic State has somewhat of a staying power in eastern Afghanistan, but it will not really spread to any of the bigger urban population centers, and it will play less of a role in other parts of the country, such as Kandahar province and Helmand and all these other provinces in southwestern Afghanistan.
Yeah, that's encouraging. I mean, particularly because, based on what you just said and based on what I've been reading about the Islamic State, it seems like, we won't wake up one day to read that Jalalabad has fallen to ISIS like we did, for Mosul last year. So it's really, or sorry, 2 years ago. But it seems that ISIS in Afghanistan is a very different phenomenon than how it exists.
It is. And when you talk to, some of the U.S. officers in the country, they just refer to them as jersey dressers. Most of them are just former Taliban that switched sides because of the money, right? Or because ISIS managed to occupy some of, the major a major drug route in the province or district, and the Taliban there are just cut off from the financial sources, and therefore they're switching sides. So I do think there's a potential for a lot of those ISIS fighters now to be persuaded to switch sides again. And also, I think the Afghan National Security and Defense Forces have actually shown that they can stand up to ISIS. I mean, the front line that I visited has not really moved for the past 70 days. ISIS has not made a lot of progress. The Afghan National Army has not made a lot of progress. It's a stalemate, but this stalemate is going to continue. I don't think the Afghan army will at any moment crack, and as you said, ISIS forces will go and occupy Jalalabad. Although there was a bit of a scare a few months ago, right at the beginning when ISIS launched its massive military campaign in the province. Also, as I said, the United States and NATO forces will simply not allow another urban population center to fall into the hands of the Taliban or ISIS. What maybe not a lot of listeners know, there is a so-called in extremis order, a standing in extremis order by NATO, by the NATO Resolute Support Mission in the country, which stipulates that if a major urban population center in Afghanistan is under threat of attack or under threat of being taken over by the insurgents, U.S. air power or NATO air power can be used even without any NATO forces under attack or NATO forces on the ground, just to save this, critical city or town. And I think, with that order alone, and sorry, this order will, whenever something like, an incident occurs, it is in place for 24 hours, after which it will be reviewed by the overall commander of the NATO Resolute Support Mission in the country, and then it can be extended or canceled, for another 24 hours, depending on how the situation on the ground is. So I do think that NATO and U.S. forces have learned a lesson from Iraq. They've learned a lesson from Kunduz. And I don't think we'll see another fall of an urban population center in 2016, at least not for a prolonged period of time.
That's very encouraging to hear. I hope you're right about that. Now, Franz, finally, we are nearing the end of this podcast, but I do want to ask you about, your personal experience as a journalist reporting in Afghanistan on the front line. Obviously, it's not easy to report out of places like this. Do you maybe want to talk a bit about some of the challenges that you faced while you were there?
Sure. First of all, it's very, very difficult to get to some of those places when you are trying to embed with the Afghan forces. For example, I had to drive on Highway 1 from Kabul to Jalalabad through the Kowet-Bakman Mountains along the 64-kilometer-long Kabul River Gorge in order to get to Jalalabad and embed with the 201st Corps. And just a brief side note, it was in those mountains that the British sustained the second worst defeat in their military history in the 1840s. The worst military defeat of the British in British military history was, of course, the fall of Singapore in February 1942. But first of all, I think it's just it's very difficult logistic-wise to really report on the ground in the country at this stage. Also because NATO has substantially drawn down its resources. It's, there are only around, I think, 20 bases left in the country. It's, some of those bases are off limits to journalists. And then, of course, NATO forces themselves also don't go out on patrols anymore, on combat patrols. They merely patrol a perimeter around their base. And it's very difficult also to get on one of those missions at this stage of the conflict, because of course they're, you know, they don't want to jeopardize the lives of any of of a reporter. But I think generally 90% of reporting, or 90% of my time, was essentially spent on logistics, security considerations, trying to get the right people to talk to, trying to reach, a destination within a certain amount of time, and also just constantly trying to figure out what is going on the ground, what is the security situation. And I think a lot of it has changed. And generally, this is now my, I think, sixth or seventh trip to Kabul or to Afghanistan. And this is the first time where really there was a subjective, and I really emphasized the word subjective, sense of insecurity in the city that I had not previously witnessed in my past trips. And I'm not 100% sure where it is coming from, because ostensibly from what I could see, not that much has changed in Kabul over the last couple of years. Of course, you have less Westerners there, less foreigners, and less of a Western military presence in the streets. But still, overall, security in the capital seems to be just about the same as it was a few years ago. But I think this subjective sense of insecurity also somehow influences your work while you're in the country, and you're generally a bit more nervous and a bit more concerned about your own personal security, which sometimes I think inhibits also you in a way, and also inhibits the stories that you're trying to pursue while you are in the country.
Yeah. Absolutely. And Franz, I have to say, I mean, I think it's, of all the times we're reporting from Afghanistan, this is probably one of the most critical. I mean, if you look at, at least in the United States, Afghanistan has kind of fallen off the map. I mean, just yesterday we saw Obama's State of the Union speech, and Afghanistan was hardly mentioned. As far as the United States is concerned, this war ended. But as someone who was just there, that's very much still on. And obviously the Afghan people know that it's very much still on. And this is all very helpful perspective going into 2016, and I hope some of your predictions are stick, particularly the lack of any more incidents with major urban population centers like Kunduz throughout the year. I think that will be at least necessary at a baseline for the peace talks to proceed. Listeners may know that this week representatives from Pakistan, China, the United States, and the Afghan government are meeting in Pakistan to discuss the a possible resumption of peace talks that fell apart last summer. So that will, again, be something to keep an eye on. Franz, thanks a lot for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you, Ankit.
Yeah, and we'll hope to have you back on soon to maybe talk about some of the defense writing you do as well. I'd love to do that in the future.
Sounds good.
Yeah, and for our listeners, please do leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe to this podcast if you like what you hear. We cover a variety of topics in the Asia-Pacific, as we do at The Diplomat. And keep an eye out for Franz's writing in the description to this podcast. Thanks for listening.